I'd like to turn to Romans 8 for a moment. I think it's good sometimes just to kind of settle back and let the Lord tell us what He's done for us, what He thinks of us. And so here in Romans 8, verse 28, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to His purpose." And now notice, "For whom He did foreknow, He also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom He did predestinate, them He also called. And whom He called, them He also justified. And whom He justified, them He also glorified. What shall we then say to these things?" Well, I think that expression, "What shall we say to these things?" are really, perhaps we might say, we just marvel at them, we wonder at them, to think that we were foreknown, we were predestinated, we were called, we were justified, we were glorified. And that's the end of the picture, isn't it? The whole theme comes out there. And I sometimes think of it as a golden chain that stretches from eternity to eternity. Five golden links in it. Foreknown, predestinated, called, justified, glorified. Well, we couldn't believe it if we didn't read it in the Word. But how thankful we can be for it. And perhaps it's been said, maybe the reason that we're losing some of our young people is because they've never really been established in the counsels of God and God's desire toward us. And now I'd just like to digress from this for a minute and turn to the 33rd of Numbers. And we'll come back to it, but I just kind of want to work up to these wonderful things that God has accomplished. And now in this 33rd chapter of Numbers, you have 40 encampments of the children of Israel. Now, I don't know, there may have been more, but there are 40 encampments here. And you know, an encampment is what we might say, it was a certain experience in the life of the children of Israel. And there is no fault found with them in any way in this chapter. It was always that they journeyed, they encamped, and they went forward, but there was no fault found with them. And so it's a little picture of our journey through this wilderness, through this world. And we'll just hit a few high spots to bring out the thought of these encampments. Now, I believe that the children of Israel did not take the next encampment until they had learned the lesson of the one they were at. And so it is with us. Perhaps we abide maybe pretty long in one encampment because we haven't really learned what God is trying to tell us in connection with it. But there's something else that we have to realize, that personally, you know, you take a man my age, maybe we're in encampment 30 or 35, but there are young men and young Christians that maybe are only in encampment number 3 or 4. And so we have to learn to have patience with them. We can't expect a God to deal, or should we say, teach real quickly, because God has an order the way he does a thing, and you don't become a giant, you know, in a short time in the things of God. It just doesn't work. So we have to bear with the younger ones, and then the younger ones have to bear with us too. But now notice it says, these are the journeys of the children of Israel, which went forth out of the land of Egypt with their armies under the hand of Moses and Aaron. Now Moses and Aaron are both a type of Christ. Moses, of course, is the type of Christ as a leader, and Aaron a type of Christ as the priest, or the in his priestly service. And so it says in verse 3 now, and they departed from Rameses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the morrow after the Passover. Now remember that we could never take the wilderness journey if we hadn't partaken of the Passover. The Passover, you know, in the first place, the blood was applied. And so that is very vital for everyone to have had the blood applied. That is, that we have come under the precious blood of Christ. And then it adds a further here, or we might say in connection with the Passover, why strength was gained for the journey. You know, they fed on the roast lamb. And how vital that is for the journey in the desert, in the wilderness, to feed on the Christ as the roast lamb, the one that suffered for us and has tasted something of this very thing. Now, one more thing here in that verse. The children of Israel went out with an high hand in the sight of all the Egyptians. Now, how vital it is that we go out in the sight of the world, as it were. That is, that the world knows that we've gone out from them. Now, we never know. Sometimes you find souls, maybe you find some great activity among souls, but you wonder if they've left Egypt. Here they went out in the sight of all Egyptians and the Egyptians, and I think it's good if the world knows that we have left them behind. And then we will drop down to verse 7, and they removed from Itham and turned again unto Pahirah, which is before Baal Zephon, and so forth. Well, that still wasn't out of Egypt, was it? I think Mr. Darby made the comment that most of the Christians that he knew didn't get any further than Pi-Hei-Arah. Well, perhaps it's true that many don't get beyond that. That is, under the blood, but not out of Egypt. But, beloved saints of God, we have been called to be a special people to the Lord. And to be tangled in the world is no testimony at all. No testimony to the world. If anything, it might be a stumble to the world. But anyway, now they come to Merah in verse 8. The end of the verse, it says, and went 3 days' journey in the wilderness of Itham and pitched at Merah. Well, we know what took place at Merah, you know. They had gone for 3 days' journey into the wilderness, and they found that the water was bitter. Well, that's true, you know. I sometimes have noticed this. I've noticed saints that have been gathered to the Lord's name, that just about the third year, they come into a real testing. And I've noticed it on this trip, too, that that for some reason or other, about that time, there is a real testing. At first, we're all kind of enamored, and we think this is it. We've reached the place and all, and there's a certain joy. But then, after about the third year, there's a, a testing comes in, and perhaps we find the waters bitter. And it's true, but now the word was, we remember that, was that they were to take wood and put it into the water. Now, our translation says a tree, but that really isn't the right word. It's wood. Put wood into the water. Well, what does the wood speak of? The wood speaks of the humanity of the Lord Jesus. That perfect man, that one that walked this desert before we walked it. And to put that into the water, well, that makes the water sweet. I think we've all experienced it, just to stop and think of our blessed Lord at times when things become rather bitter, and put a little of himself into the water, that the water becomes sweet. And if we haven't done that, let's do it. I know there's lots of pressures and trials coming on nowadays, and it's wonderful to know the Lord in such a way that we can put him into the water, into this this bitter stream. And if we do, there's some results, aren't there? Now that's the next verse, verse 9. And they removed from Marah and came to Elam. And Elam, in Elam were 12 fountains of water and 70 palm trees. Well, you know, you can hardly think of the 12 and 70 without thinking of the 12 apostles and then the 70 which he sent out. First the 12 and then the 70. Here there were 12 wells and 70 palm trees. Now, where we put Christ in the water, as it were, and it becomes sweet, then there's soul progress. But if I maintain bitterness and don't take advantage, should we say, of putting Christ into the water, I'm not going to make any progress. I'm not going to experience what these 12 wells are. And we think of the ministry that the apostles have left us, and the privilege that we have of benefiting from it. And then the 70 palm trees, palm speaks of victory. It speaks of overcoming. So God always has an order. It isn't just a conglomeration of things. But it's wonderful to experience what we might say being an overcomer. In Revelation 2 and 3, we have an overcomer spoken of at least 7 times. Well, then we can drop down to verse 16. Or we know what happened at Kibrath Hatava. Now again, there's no fault found here, but there, you know, is where they despised the manna. And they began to grind it and make it more palatable, I suppose, and they baked it in cakes. But you know what it says there? It says the taste was like fresh oil. Well, that wasn't really the way that manna was really tasted. The taste was of wafers and honey. That was the taste of manna. But what is the thought of the fresh oil? Well, I believe, no matter how you try to fix up the word, should we say, and try to make it palatable, and they did that because they kind of despised the manna, as it were. But still, the oil, you know, speaks of the Spirit of God. And no matter how you would use the word, still there's a convicting influence or a convicting power in connection with it. If it wouldn't be, you wouldn't be trying to make it different. And of course, that's the place where God gave them quail to eat. They wanted quail, and so they ate quail for 30 days until it said it came out of their throats. Well, that took place there. But think of the lesson God taught them. Don't find them asking for quail again. So God, in his wisdom, as he takes us from encampment to encampment, why, he is going to carry out his purposes. Well, then, at Hazeroth, you know, what happened there was that Aaron and Miriam found fault with Moses for, well, of course, they used it for an excuse that he had married an Ethiopian woman, but really that wasn't the reason, that was an excuse. The reason, they wanted more place than they were getting, and so they find fault with Moses. And you know, there's an expression there, it's a solemn expression that says, God heard it. That's all it takes sometimes, for God to hear it. And it's a real exercise, I believe, at any time that we say something, to recognize that God heard it. And the Miriam were stricken with leprosy, and then the whole camp had to stay in that one place until Miriam was recovered. And you know, that reminds us of something too, doesn't it? Many times such a thing maybe happens in an assembly where a leper shows up. Well, I believe the reason, we might get one reason that they didn't journey, is because what Aaron and Miriam had done was in the hearts of all the people. Sometimes somebody gets ahead of us in expressing themselves, and so we look like we're in the clear. But none of them journeyed until Miriam was recovered to the camp again. And that's a good assembly principle too, isn't it? That we don't really, if a problem has arisen, we don't act like nothing was on, but the whole assembly becomes exercised as to it. Well, we jumped over the Red Sea, but we just don't have time to go into all of it. But there are four types of the death of Christ in the wilderness journey. Now, we know the first one is the Passover lamb, and the second one is the Red Sea, Christ dying for us. The third one is the brazen serpent, and the fourth one is the Jordan. Now, all these come in their right order. Perhaps like the brazen serpent, well, that didn't come in till the 39th year of the wilderness journey. And what do we learn from the brazen serpent? Well, the brazen serpent is really the seventh of Romans, where we learn that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. But when do we learn that? You know, the Lord began his ministry with the brazen serpent. And if we really took in the truth of the brazen serpent, why, we wouldn't have to go through 39 years of wilderness experience to learn it. But I believe most of us have had to go through, as it were, those 39 years before we really learned what we were, what we are by nature. And after the children of Israel learned that, it says that they journeyed. That is, they journeyed toward the sun rising. The sun rising, you know, speaks of the coming of the Lord. And so when we come to the end of ourselves, well, then Christ is really magnified, and our journey is in that direction. So then we come to the last encampment. And that's where I want to really come to. Verse 49. They pitched by Jordan, verse 48, and they departed from the mountain of Barim and pitched in the plains of Moab by Jordan near Jericho. Now notice where they pitched there. And This was their last encampment now before going into Canaan. And so I just want to liken this now, the journey of the children of Israel, to the journey of the church through this wilderness for 2,000 years. And we're right now at the last encampment. We feel that our next step will be to be ushered into the glory, looking at the land of Canaan as the glory. So here they are. And here I believe where the church is today is right at the ushering in to the glory. But now I'd like to point out some of the things that are available at that last encampment. And it's almost unbelievable the things that are still available, should we say, today. But the things that were available at the last encampment, if you'll just turn back to chapter 22, I would just like to show you. Chapter 22, we have the three parables of Balaam in these next chapters. But notice that first verse, "And the children of Israel set forward and pitched in the plains of Moab on this side Jordan by Jericho." That's exactly the same verse that we read in the 33rd of Numbers, that last encampment. And now the things that are available at this last encampment, they start here at chapter 22. They go through the book of Numbers. They go through all the book of Deuteronomy. And three chapters in Joshua all take place at this last encampment. And so in that, we might learn if we couldn't begin in a year to take it up, the things that are available, should we say, at the last encampment. But I'm amazed at Moses. If you only had a month to live, what would you be talking about? How would you spend your time? Well, Moses had just about a month to live. And here he goes through all these things with the children of Israel, from chapter 22 on through Deuteronomy and three chapters in Joshua is what Moses takes up, and what tremendous instruction comes in at that time. Now, I just assume that you know a little of these parables. One thing that's taking place here is Balaam and Balak are talking together, and their conversation is that the children of Israel be cursed. Now, little we realize the work in darkness, as it were, the work that's going on behind the scenes by the enemy of the believer. Many things happen, and we blame it, onto second causes or something like that. But we don't realize that behind the scenes there's been a conversation of the enemy. You know, it speaks, doesn't it, in Matthew of the gates of hell. It says the gates of hell shall not prevail against the church, but it surely, surely they're trying. So this is going on, and so it's nice to realize that. But now, in spite of the enemy talking back and forth here, we might just read a few of those verses to get the thought. Verse 5 of chapter 22, "He sent messengers therefore unto Balaam the son of Peor to Pethor, which is by the river of the land of the children of Israel to call him, saying, Behold, there is a people come out from Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me. Come now, therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people, for they are too mighty for me. Peradventure, I shall prevail, and so forth. Well, this is going on now behind the scenes. Here the children of Israel are all in camp at this last encampment. And it seems like perhaps today Satan is making one more effort to destroy the testimony if he can. And beloved saints of God, I believe we ought to draw nearer to the Lord than ever before today, this very day. But now what comes out through the enemy trying to curse the people of God? Well, let's turn to chapter 23. Now, what's subtle about this is that it has a religious cast to it. Verse 1 of chapter 23, And Balaam said unto Balak, Build me here 7 altars, and prepare me here 7 oxen and 7 rams, very much, the worship of the children of Israel was. And Balak did as Balaam had spoken, and Balaam offered on every altar a bullock and a ram. And Balaam said unto Balak, Stand by thy burnt offering, and I will go peradventure. The Lord will come to meet me, and whatsoever he showeth me, I will tell thee. And he went to an high place. Can you imagine language like that coming out of the mouth of the wicked Balaam? And Balak, who wanted to curse the people of God, and yet he connects the Lord with it. And there's so much today of the Lord's name is connected with it, and unless we have discernment, it's going to have a bad effect. And I've noticed on this trip that there are some poor young folks that are becoming under the influence of this kind of a thing. You know, the first time that I ever heard about Balaam or the word Balaam was from our brother J.W. Penfield. I don't know if anybody knows him here, but he's long with the Lord. But a certain man that was supposedly a Christian took a pastorship in one of the churches in Walla Walla. And he had visited with the man from time to time, and I suppose he had had some Christian fellowship with him. But he said, I hope he's not a Balaam. Well, of course, I didn't know what he meant. I hope he's not a Balaam, but then perhaps by now I kind of know what he meant. You know, Balaam loved the reward, didn't he? He wanted the money that was connected with it. That was what he was taken up with. So we want to be careful about that. But the treachery of this man to come in this way. And verse 7 then, now he took up his parable and said, Balak the king of Moab hath brought me from Aram out of the mountains of the east, saying, Come curse me, Jacob, and come defy Israel. How shall I curse whom God hath not cursed? Or how shall I defy whom the Lord hath not defied? That's Romans 8, isn't it? How can Satan curse what God has wrought? Here in our chapter we find the expression, what God hath wrought. Well, in Romans 8, what shall we say to these things? So here we have the first thought in connection with, you know, foreknowledge and predestination, that took place in eternity. But calling and justifying and glorifying has taken place in time. And so, first thought, in connection with, you know, foreknowledge and predestination, that took place in eternity. But calling and justifying and glorifying has taken place in time. And so here I believe we get that first thought brought out, the thought of being called. How shall I curse whom God hath not cursed? How shall I defy whom the Lord hath not defied? For from the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I behold him. Lo, the people shall dwell alone, and shall not be reckoned among the nations. So we have been called, haven't we, to be a special people unto the Lord. We've been called to dwell alone, not to be reckoned among the nations. You know, we can come closer home than that. I've sometimes felt, you know, that those of us that God has gathered on divine ground, I say it humbly, but we don't have to become like the nations. We don't have to go to the nations for support. My people shall dwell alone, as much as to say, I'm able to take care of them. They don't need support from anybody else. Don't have to join the council of churches or anything like that. But my people shall dwell alone. And I believe that's where the thought of calling comes in. And now it says here, who can count the dust of Jacob and the number of the fourth part of Israel? Who can count the dust of Jacob? Sometimes said, you know, that we're standing on a cemetery, and quite likely it's true. But think when the rapture takes place, when the shout comes from heavens, the millions of souls that will rise. Who could count the dust of Jacob? Those that have been laid in the earth years and years ago, all the Old Testament saints from Abel on down are going to respond to that call. Oh, think of the power of God when that shout comes. Who can count the dust of Jacob? And then it adds fourth part of Israel. Now we might liken that to the saints that are left. Think of the millions, perhaps, that will respond to that call when the blessed Lord shouts from heaven. Who can count the dust of Jacob or the fourth part of Israel? What a wonderful outlook we have to the dead in Christ shall rise first. You know, in the cemetery there are many that have passed on, but they're not all going to rise. The dead in Christ are going to rise first. But my, you know, the graves won't have to be open to let those out, those of his own that are in the graves. No. They didn't have to roll the stone away to let the Lord out. They rolled it away so we could look in, as it were. But the Lord didn't need that stone rolled away. And neither will the graves open up. But God will call out of this world those left of his own. Now, no wonder Balaam makes a comment, let me die the death of the righteous, and let my last end be like his. Well, you know, it's a wonderful thing to die the death of the righteous. You could covet to die the death of the righteous. Because I believe I've seen both die, both unbelievers and believers. Thinking of a case where a man was taken to the hospital, and he was a businessman, not too old, And he was just determined that the doctor was not to let him die. He wasn't ready to die. He didn't want to die. And the language that he used was really unbelievable, and the noise that he made. Well, Balaam wouldn't want to die that kind of a death. But I'm thinking of another sister that departed from this world, and she, after she said goodbye to her children, she says, I hear the most beautiful singing. And very shortly, she left this world. Well, what a difference. Let me die the death of the righteous. But you know, he goes further than that. Let my last end be like his. Balaam, he wanted his last end to be like the righteous. What is the last end of the righteous? Well, after resurrection, they're taken to glory. But you know, Balaam didn't do anything about it. He made that expression, and perhaps others make those same expressions. Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my last end be like his. But as near as we can tell, he put forth no effort that it might be so. Fact is, you can well tell that he didn't, because he tried to continue to curse the children of Israel. But here I believe we might get whom he did predestinate, them he also called. Here he calls. My people shall dwell alone, and so forth. But now we come to, verse 21. And here I believe we get whom he called, them he also justified. Now, beloved saints of God, as we begin to view these things, we could go to chapter from chapter to chapter and see some of the tremendous things that God has for those that love him. All things work together for good to those that love him. So verse 21, he hath not beheld iniquity in Jacob, neither hath he seen perverseness in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. Now in chapter, the first verse that we read was, for from the top of the rocks I see him. Isn't it wonderful to look at our brethren from the top of the rocks? Well, if we looked at them from the top of the rocks, we would see them the way God sees them. And how is it that we can see them in that way? Well, it's really because he has made us that way, like this verse, verse 21. He hath not beheld iniquity in Jacob, neither hath he seen perverseness in Israel. How could he say that? Perhaps just at the time they might have been bickering with each other and having a bad time. And yet the Lord viewed them from the top of the rocks. You know, we sometimes get quite a different impression of our brother if we can see him from the top of the rocks. If we can see him the way God sees him, if we can see him as a brother for whom Christ died, it gives us such a different slant of him. And really, if Christ has died for a brother, he must be fairly valuable, must be very valuable. And if God esteems him valuable, how does it sound in God's ears if I say he isn't valuable? So I think it's nice sometimes just to get a hold of God's thoughts. And that chain, you know, that's never going to break. You and I were in God's thoughts in the beginning, before the foundation of the world. We're going to end up in the glory. You remember that sheet that came down from heaven, Peter, in Peter's presence? And that sheet came down, spoke to the four corners of the sheet. That would speak of universal, wouldn't it? And it came down from heaven, and here were all manner of four-footed beasts, and creeping things, and fowls. And then, pretty soon, it goes back up to heaven. Well, we learn from that, dear brethren, that our origin was in heaven. You know, on that sheet, there were all kinds of animals, and it really, Peter was getting the lesson that God was going to bless the Gentiles. We think of a four-footed creature like a horse. That's a pretty nice animal. And so there are some pretty nice people get saved. They're in that sheet. And then there might be the wild beasts. Well, that's something like maybe some of us were. Even the Apostle Paul was kind of a wild beast. And then there were the birds, those that were, we might say, were all really unclean animals, but still, you and I had our origin in heaven, and we have our destiny in heaven. You know, that's the reason the angels rejoice when they see a soul saved. Because the angels know where the elect are. You know, in this very city of Des Moines, where the elect are. And when one of those elect yield to the Lord, why, there's joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner that repented. So one by one, they're being called in. And just to verify this, turn to him in the back part of the book. Sometimes poetry can make it better than we can. And in verse 4, verse 2 of hymn 43. Now, it's the back part of the book, hymn 43 and verse 2. As thine thou didst foreknow us from all eternity, thy chosen loved ones ever kept present to thine eye. And when was come the moment, thou calling by thy grace, didst gently, firmly draw us each from his hiding place. Well, what a picture that is when God called us from our hiding place. But we had our beginning in heaven. And so in our verse here, I have not beheld iniquity in Jacob, neither perverseness in Israel, which bring in the thought of justification. We are justified by faith. That's first verse of chapter 5 of Romans. Being justified by faith, we have peace with God. And how could we be justified? Well, it's the last verse of Romans 4, where he was delivered for our offenses and raised again for our justification. So it says here, verse 22, God brought them out of Egypt. He hath, as it were, the strength of a unicorn. And that is, God has that strength. Surely there's no enchantment against Jacob. No, there's no way that we can be plucked out of his hand. Neither is there any divination against Israel according to this time, as it shall be said of Jacob and of Israel, what hath God wrought? Well, we can marvel at that and say that too. What hath God wrought? Are we any better than anybody else? No. But God, in his mercy, has included us in that sheet. Before the foundation of the world, whom he did foreknow, them he also predestinated. And whom he called, them he justified. And now once more we have the other. Whom he justified, them he also glorified. So I believe we get that in chapter 24. Now we might say, of course, maybe it'd be a little hard to find fault with them on the top of the rocks. But notice now, he isn't on top of the rocks. And when Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he went not as other times to seek for enchantments, but he set his face toward the wilderness. Now they were in the wilderness, and yet what is said about them? Balaam lifted up his eyes. He saw Israel abiding in their tents according to their tribes. Think of it. Around the tabernacle, four tribes on each side, and the Spirit of God came upon them. And he took up his parable and said, Balaam the son of Beor hath said, and a man whose eyes are open has said, he hath said, which heard the words of the Lord, which saw the vision of the Almighty, falling into a trance, but having his eyes open. How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy tabernacles, O Israel. Well, think of looking at these people in the wilderness and coming up with a statement like that. You know, goodly tents. I sometimes use that verse at a wedding. Setting up a goodly tent. I believe that, you know, the assembly is composed of households, and how vital it is to have goodly tents. To have a household where the Lord is appreciated, where the Lord is reverenced. And I often say, you know, assemblies are composed of households, and the condition of the assembly is largely affected by households. And so we get both here. How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy tabernacles, O Israel. Well, let's at least apply it that way. The tents would be the household, and the tabernacles would be the assemblies. Well, are they goodly? And yet the Lord, what he has made us in Christ, he views them as goodly here. Whom he justified, he also glorified. I sometimes say, if you get discouraged about things, take a look at Revelation 21, where you see the church coming out of heaven in all her glory and beauty. When did John see that? He saw it very shortly after the church was formed. He saw the thing in its finished product. And that's the way you and I are going to see it when we get to glory. But isn't it encouraging to realize that God is going to carry out his purposes from the very beginning of foreknowing till glorifying? He's going to carry that out. But you know what it does? It really exercises our hearts that we might, should we say, that we might add up a bit to this. As he says here, as the valleys are they spread forth. You know, the valley, especially where we farm, the valley is the most fertile place and where you get the most productive crops. And here he views his people as in the valley. It's the way he views you and me. I wonder if we could get a hold of these things, if we would take up Christianity as a kind of a chore and kind of a drab thing, a thing that we better carry on with. No, if we could get God's thoughts of us, I believe there would be a real response. Have you ever tried that on your wife? Perhaps you think she's not doing quite much she ought to, maybe taking care of the house and things. And you might say to her, well, honey, I really appreciate the way you did this. Well, next time she's going to try harder to do it that way. And so if we express our appreciation, often there is no end of the devotedness of a wife. And It's the same if we can get a little glimpse of what the Lord has done for us, why, and what he thinks of us. We'd like to kind of add up. And then it adds, as gardens by the riverside. Well, a garden, you know, the Song of Solomon is full, often speaks of the garden. And the garden is for the enjoyment of the owner. You might have a big, large farm, and you might farm part of it, and then you might have part of it where for a public park. But right at the house, there's a garden, and that's for the owner's enjoyment and whoever he wants to bring into it. So he looks here at his people as a garden. Now, as the trees of Lion, Illinois. Well, what about that tree? Well, that's a tree that's in the east that's known for its fragrance. And not only known for its fragrance, but the older it gets, the more fragrant it becomes. And that's a real exercise, isn't it, for those of us that are older? Wouldn't it be nice if we would become more fragrant? That is, give off a little more of smelling Christ, that they might smell Christ on us. And instead of dropping by the way, as it were, how wonderful to become more fragrant, more for Christ as we go on. And then it says, as a cedar tree beside the waters. Well, the cedar tree, you know, is that stately tree. The Lord is likened to a cedar tree. The Lord was stately in going. There was a dignity with the Lord. You know, we've been called a special people. We've been called out. We've been called out of the world. How wonderful if we could, as it were, have a bearing through this world that would attract people. You know, the world doesn't read the Bible, but they read the believer. And it's really sad sometimes if we give a wrong impression of Christianity. And if we get a wrong impression of Christianity, we give a wrong impression of Christ along with it. But here it speaks of as the cedar tree beside the waters. He shall pour the water out of his buckets. Well, now why does it say buckets? We've had water here before by the riverside, but now it's buckets. Well, a bucket has a measure to it, doesn't it? And so we all have our measure, should we say. We might be able to refresh others. I saw somebody the other day watering their orchard with a bucket. Well, we all have our measure, but it's nice if our measure were a little bigger today than it was a year ago or 2 years ago. And that would bring out the thought, wouldn't it, of growth and spiritual progress, to have just a little bigger bucket in refreshing, as it were, God's garden. And then we have, and his seed shall be in many waters. Now, what would that tell us of? It probably would remind us of the gospel seed, wouldn't it? Cast thy bread upon the waters, and thou shalt find it after many days. My, how precious it is to have the desire that other souls might have what you have. And so, it's wonderful to to realize what we are, what Christ has made us, but that shouldn't make us just self-satisfied, as it were. It's wonderful to have an exercise and a desire toward souls. And then it ends up here, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Now Agag was the king of Amalek, yes. And it's just in contrast to the Lord, isn't it? We might think of Agag as the head of the old creation, the first man, but Christ is the head of the new creation, and he is going to have the preeminence. Yeah, and his king shall be higher than Agag. You know, beloved saints of God, we've got the best in every way. We got the best in this life and that which is to come. And when I think of how short the time is,